Sessions in the Hot Seat, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Attorney General Sessions faces tough questions from the Senate Intelligence Committee, including about contacts with Russian officials prior to the election.
I have never met with or had any conversation with any Russians or any foreign officials concerning any type of interference with any campaign or election in the United States.
Meanwhile, there's more evidence of Russian efforts to hack last year's vote.
This is a really worrisome thing. These are capabilities that could be used, you know, in 2018 in our midterm elections.
Plus, who says you need real instruments to make a record?
A sledgehammer, a beer bottle, the bow and arrow, frying pan, etc.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says he never discussed any type of election interference with the Russians. That's one of the biggest headlines to come out of today's highly anticipated testimony by Sessions before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Before even taking any questions from committee members, the Attorney General began with a fiery denial of any wrongdoing.
A suggestion that I participated in any collusion, that I was aware of any collusion with the Russian government to hurt this country, which I have served with honor for 35 years, or to undermine the integrity of our democratic process, is an appalling and detestable lie.
Sessions then submitted himself to hours of questions about the ongoing Russia investigation and President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey. But at several points, he refused to discuss his private conversations with President Trump on any matters relevant to the committee's work.
I am not stonewalling. I am following the historic policies of the Department of Justice. You don't walk into any hearing or committee meeting and reveal confidential communications with the President of the United States, who's entitled to receive confidential communications in your best judgment about a host of issues.
That's how Sessions answered a question from Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon. Wyden then pressed him further, specifically about the circumstances surrounding Sessions deciding to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. And things got testy.
General Sessions, respectfully, you're not answering the
question. Well, what is the question?
The question is, Mr. Comey said that there were matters with respect to the recusal that were problematic and he couldn't talk about them. What are they?
Why don't you tell me? There are none, Senator Wyden. There are none. I can tell you that for absolute certainty. This is a secret innuendo being leaked out there about me, and I don't appreciate it. And I've tried to give my best and truthful answers to any committee I've appeared before. And it's really people are suggesting through innuendo that I have been not honest about matters, and I've tried to be honest.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking there before the Senate Intelligence Committee. David Rennie is Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. He says Sessions dodged some difficult questions this afternoon.
There were moments when he was very passionate in defending his character, but then there were moments where he was kind of, I saw someone talking about him being squirrely on Twitter, and I think that's fair. So there were specific things, given that he was a very early congressional supporter of Donald Trump and integral to the Trump campaign. He was asked some pretty pointed questions about the moment during the Republican National Convention last summer when the Republican Party platform was changed to take out support for sending lethal weaponry to Ukraine in its fight with Russia. And that's a pretty important moment. It's a pretty revealing moment if, as alleged by some press reports, there were figures in the Trump campaign that were trying to do Russia a favor, essentially. And there, the kind of confident, you know, it's a detestable lie kind of Jeff Sessions suddenly became very, very kind of vague, and he didn't recall and he wasn't sure that he knew. And he basically dodged those questions. And so I think if you were a defender of Jeff Sessions wanting to see him brush aside every single allegation that he knows something about, just the unusual nature of the Trump campaign's relationship with Russia and view of Russia, even geopolitically, I don't think he really cleared all of that up today, because there were several moments where his memory suddenly failed him and he didn't recall a whole bunch of stuff.
And I think also the senators on the committee didn't ask him in a pointed way about that odd relationship and odd approach by the Trump administration to Russia. But in other ways, I mean, several times the attorney general, he simply refused to discuss his private discussions with President Trump regarding any of these topics. How did that strike you? I mean, did that strike you as stonewalling?
It was clearly stonewalling, although we did finally get a hint of a kind of quasi-legal justification for his refusal to answer some of these questions. He didn't want, if you like, to prevent the president from being able to claim executive privilege later, which didn't seem to go down terribly well with some of the lawyers who are now senators in the room. And he saw some pretty testy exchanges, particularly with people like Angus King, the independent senator from Maine, Kamala Harris, a former state attorney general from California, essentially very unconvinced by this kind of line of reasoning.
How do you think the attorney general's testimony played outside the U.S.? I mean, will Europeans, you know, they have a lot of questions about Russian attempts to meddle in their elections. Do you think Europeans will feel any better after hearing Sessions today?
I think there is bafflement and alarm among European allies that the Trump administration just doesn't feel like a regular administration that you would expect from America, and doesn't feel at all like the regular Republican administration. And I think one of the things that allies find very difficult is that when they see people like the Defense Secretary James Mattis or the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and they hear them give speeches at, you know, NATO meetings of ministers or in European contexts, the message is absolutely kind of conventional Republican suspicion and hostility towards Russia, and it's all very reassuring. But then once you start listening to President Trump, and he pointedly declined to defend Article 5 at the NATO summit last month, and then when you get into this whole business of Russian hacking, there's just kind of bafflement and unhappiness that President Trump and the people closest to him seem so kind of furtive, if you like, about this whole saga of what is, as you say, a very familiar experience for Europeans, which is an obvious Russian attack on their democracies, which we've seen in Germany, we saw in France, we even saw in Britain, perhaps during the Brexit referendum.
What do you think happens next? I mean, where are all these investigations heading?
Well, you've got to believe that as long as the special counsel, Robert Mueller, isn't sacked, and we clearly don't know whether there was a kind of kite being flown yesterday when we had reports that perhaps the president talked to people close to him about sacking Mueller, that's got to remain the investigation which has the most legal teeth and which is the one that is not obviously clouded by partisanship. Because these congressional hearings are all very well, and I think actually some of the Republican senators deserve some praise because they are going further than I think some skeptics expected them to. And I would say that Senator Burr, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has actually held a bunch of pretty tough hearings, given that he's a Republican investigating a president from his own party. But at the end of the day, congressional hearings, they may look like a court of law and senators can sound like prosecutors, but bitter experience over modern history is that they are ultimately political bodies and that they're not really independent judicial bodies. They are ultimately guided by politics and which party holds the majority.
David Rennie is Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. In recent months, we've learned a lot about Russian attempts to hack into the U.S. electoral system. Now it turns out there's lots we didn't know. Bloomberg correspondent Jordan Robertson and his colleague Michael Riley broke new ground on the story today. They're reporting that those hacking efforts can be traced to the Russian government. And they're much more extensive than previously thought, aimed at gaining access to voter databases in 39 U.S. states. Here's how Jordan Robertson described what happened in Illinois.
The hackers in Illinois, there's digital evidence showing that they were trying to both change information in Illinois' voter registration database and or delete it. And specifically, they were trying to change things such as name and address. If you want to create chaos at the polls, tampering with that data is a pretty good way to do it.
And so did any of it work?
The information we have in Illinois is that the attackers were unsuccessful. And the best analysis we've heard is that this was a reconnaissance mission. 2016 was all about figuring out, what do we have access to as hackers? What works? What doesn't work? And a lot of this kind of experimentation was occurring at both the state and county level. So the folks we've talked to said this was probably part of that process.
How was it traced back to the Russians?
They're essentially digital fingerprints. And, you know, there's an important distinction here to make. And it's a good question because there are both public and private signatures is what they're called in the cybersecurity industry. But these are indicators of either like, you know, a piece of malicious software that an attacker uses, internet protocol addresses, computer servers from which they launch these attacks. Public signatures or public fingerprints of attacks are a lot less useful than private signatures, which is what we're talking about here. And these are signatures that the government keeps. They're classified. You know, if an attacker targets a system that's being monitored by the U.S. government and they have these classified signatures or indicators of compromise.
So you can tell.
They're able to flag literally instantly. They can tell this is attacker ABC because we're watching them very closely. And that's what was happening here. These flares were going up at the Department of Homeland Security.
But does it link right back to the Russian government or just somebody in Russia?
The NSA and the U.S. government has attributed these attacks to the Russian GRU. That's military intelligence in Russia. So, you know, when it comes to attribution of these attacks, that's about as clear-cut as you can get.
Now, these intrusions, they weren't limited to Illinois. They were detected in 39 states.
That's the big new revelation, is that previously the best number we had heard was about 20 states may have seen some sort of attack, but there's a big difference between being attacked and being compromised, having that attack actually be successful. So the news we're reporting today is that election systems in at least 39 states had these classified signatures of this Russian hacker group on these systems. And these are not just state systems, these are county systems as well. And the significance of that is counties run elections, you know, in the U.S. So if you want to tinker with voter registration data, doing it at the county level in many cases is far more effective than doing it at the state level. So this is a really worrisome thing.
So we're talking about a lot of hacks going on summer and fall of 2016. And during this time, what was the response of the Obama administration?
Another good question. You know, the Obama administration has been criticized, and in the eyes of many, rightfully so, for being far too passive on this issue. You know, publicly, there wasn't a lot said. And eventually, the administration came out and did impose some penalties on Russian military individuals that they believe were responsible for this hack. But during the campaign, I mean, we all remember that there was very little said about these activities. So that kind of belies what was happening behind the scenes. So behind the scenes, our information is that these voter registration hacks were a very high priority inside the White House. I mean, this was, you know, priority number one to monitor and figure out, is this how the election is going to be tampered with? You know, as we all saw, the best evidence points to Russians or the hackers in this case not pulling that trigger, kind of just doing reconnaissance, doing some experimentation, figuring out what's possible. But from most people's perspective, the information side of the operation, leaking emails, was far more effective. They didn't really need to go further than that, but that may not hold into the future.
Now, I know there's the famous red phone, and there was a red phone kind of communication. Tell us about that.
That's right. Yeah, the White House has, you know, kind of this non-secret but back channel to the Russian government, and it was, you know, it's set up for both nuclear conflict as well as cyber. There's a carve-out that they have for it. So it's really a hotline to say, hey, things are getting hot here. You know, we really need to talk about this urgently. And our information that we reported was that this hotline, it's really like kind of an email. It's a messaging system. It's not a real phone. But our information was that as these hacks on voter registration systems heated up, the Obama administration sent kind of a red alert to Moscow saying, hey, this is a big problem. We need you to address this. And the response they got back, according to our information, was very unconvincing, was, hey, why don't you send us some more documents, Mitt? You know, we promised to look into it. We'll get to the bottom of it.
Send us more documents.
Yeah, send us more information. Yeah. We'd really like to know more about this. And, you know, within the White House and within the Obama administration, this was obviously highly concerning because they saw the attacks continue.
Bloomberg correspondent Jordan Robertson. Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you so much. Happy to do it.
Beirut's last public beach is under threat from developers. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. Today's Senate testimony from Attorney General Jeff Sessions is the big story here in the U.S. But as always, there are other things happening around the globe we want to tell you about, so I want to tell you quickly about a couple of them. First up, an American college student being held by North Korea for the past 17 months has been released, but he's apparently in a coma and in need of serious medical care. Otto Warmbier was arrested last year while visiting the country. North Korean media reported he was caught trying to steal a propaganda banner. Later, Warmbier was put on trial for that offense and sentenced to 15 years of hard labor. Earlier today, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson announced his release this way.
At the President's direction, the Department of State has secured the release of Otto Warmbier from North Korea. He is on his way en route home to be reunited with his family. We continue our discussions with the North Korean regime regarding the release of the three other American citizens that have been detained. We have no comment on Mr. Warmbier's condition out of respect to him and the family.
According to reports, Warmbier has been in a coma for over a year after falling ill with botulism. His release came just as former basketball star Dennis Rodman announced he was heading to North Korea, but U.S. officials in Washington say the two events are not related. Also in Washington, Secretary of State Tillerson met today with the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia, Adel Al-Jubeir. The two men discussed the recent dispute between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. The Saudis, along with other Gulf nations, accuse Qatar of supporting extremism in the Middle East. That's why they decided to isolate Qatar, both diplomatically and physically, cutting off access routes to the nation. That's led to shortages of basic goods in Qatar, but the Saudi foreign minister insists it's not a blockade.
The seaports of Qatar are open. There is no blockade on them. Qatar can move goods in and out whenever they want. They just cannot use our territorial waters. So technically, this is not a blockade. We have exercised our sovereign right to prohibit them from using our airspace. We have allowed the movement of families between the two countries to happen so that we don't divide families. And we are prepared to provide Qatar with food and medical supplies should they need this.
Qatar still calls it a blockade and is actively trying to get around it. One local businessman has even come up with a plan to make sure there's enough milk in the country. According to The Guardian, the plan involves airlifting some 4,000 American and Australian cows to Qatar. I kid you not. Up until now, Qatar has relied on dairy imports from Saudi Arabia and other neighboring nations. Living in any city has its drawbacks. The noise, the smog, the inevitable congestion. Which is why many cities have places where residents can get away from all that, like parks or pedestrian squares. Or in the case of Beirut, Lebanon, a popular public beach. But those kinds of places are under threat from development in Beirut, as the world's Richard Hall found out.
For all its charm, Beirut can be a tough place to live. Ramla Al-Baida Beach, in the west of the city, is one of the few public spaces where Beirutis can escape the smog and traffic. The old lifeguard tower is a little rusty, and the few shacks on the beach have seen better days. But people really love it here. How important is the beach to you?
It's my life, the beach here. It's my life. It's my life.
That's Adel. He asked for only his first name to be used. He's 59 years old and works in a bank. He and his friend Mohammed have been coming here for 40 years. They come nearly every day, and they have the bronzed, leathery skin to prove it. They even came during the Lebanese Civil War, when Israeli gunships were just off the coast.
Anywhere, if you want to play sport, you have to pay here in Beirut. But you don't have to pay here.
But at the other end of the beach, trouble is brewing. A large grey concrete skeleton of a building juts out onto the sand. Workers are busy with hammers and drills.
Is that the building in the distance that I can see there that's the problem?
Yes, that's it. I mean, as you can see, the building is exactly on the sea, on the sand beach.
That's Mohammed Ayoub. He works for a non-profit called Nahnu, meaning we, which campaigns for the protection of public space in Lebanon. The building in question is the Eden Bay Resort. When it's finished, all 5,000 square meters of it, it will cater to Beirut's upper classes and wealthy foreign visitors. The entry fee will be unaffordable to most Beirutis.
The problem is that, you know, based on all international agreement and laws, and even Lebanese laws, and even the constitution of Lebanon, everything sand is public space. So it's strange to find someone who is pretending that he owns the sand beach.
I reached out to the developers, but got no response. Further down the coast, a popular picnic spot on the rocks was recently closed to the public. Across town, the largest and only substantial park in the city is under threat from plans to build a hospital. Even the city's downtown area is regularly closed off to the public.
The public space is the spirit of the city. I mean, it's where the city meet. It's where the children go and they play, where the young people go and do different kind of activities and develop their talents. Without public space, the people will be more stressful and bored, and they will not feel that they belong to the city.
Ayoub says it was during Lebanon's 15-year civil war that ended in 1990 when all the coastal properties and public space were snapped up by war profiteers. Today, the laws protecting public space are rendered meaningless because of another problem, corruption. A little way down the shore, I find Ahmed, a 41-year-old English teacher, walking close to the waves with his wife.
Greed, it's what makes these places are rare to find. If you were, for example, one of the businessmen and you had the opportunity to make 1,000% benefit to you, are you going to say no?
Back on the volleyball court, Adel and Mohammed stare down at the construction site intruding ominously on their beach. They worry that the beach they have been coming to all their lives will be ruined by this and future developments.
If this building stay here, all the beach is gone.
This sense that the poor are being screwed over by the rich and powerful in Lebanon pervades every aspect of life. Ayoub sees the battle to save this little patch of beach as part of a bigger fight against the corruption of Lebanon's political class. They win some fights, they lose others. But he says they're making progress.
Of course we are winning, because if you went back 5 years ago before we start, nobody were talking about public space. And now everybody is talking about that. We don't need to win tomorrow, but of course in the long term, for sure, we will get our city back.
As I'm finishing up, Adel has left the volleyball court. I see him doing sit-ups at a pace a man half his age would struggle with. He's going furiously. He's facing the ocean, his feet dug into the sand for leverage, and when he rests, he gazes out at the water. For now, at least, he's making the most of it. For The World, Richard Hall, Beirut.
For some perspective, you can compare public space in Beirut versus Manhattan. We've got that graphic, plus photos of Beirut's last remaining public beach. They're at PRI.org. I'm Carol Hills. Many Russian immigrants in the U.S. voted for Donald Trump, and they've learned how to listen to him.
Now they know how to filter his words. This is something we can accept. This is something that's nonsense.
And most of them still support Trump. That story, plus helping kids through comics in Uganda, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in the hot seat today in Washington. He testified for 2.5 hours before the Senate Intelligence Committee. The topic was the ongoing Russia investigation and everything related to it. That includes Russian efforts to hack the U.S. election last year. Senator Angus King from Maine asked Sessions about that.
Do you believe the Russians interfered with the 2016 elections?
It appears so. The intelligence community seems to be united in that. But I have to tell you, Senator King, I know nothing but what I've read in the paper. I've never received any detailed briefing on how hacking occurred or how information was alleged to have influenced the campaign.
You received no briefing on the Russian active measures in connection with the 2016 election?
No. I don't believe I ever did.
If you missed that testimony from Attorney General Sessions earlier today, you can watch the video over at PRI.org. Meanwhile, in Russia, the big story this week with big anti-corruption protests yesterday. Hundreds of protesters were arrested. That made big news all around the globe. But most Russian media outlets played the protests down. Not surprising, since most Russian media outlets are either aligned with or controlled by the Kremlin. That allows President Vladimir Putin to effectively control what's on the radio and TV. But he hasn't been so successful online, which is where many young Russians get their entertainment and their news. They use Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, even YouTube. That's the platform opposition leader Alexei Navalny has used to get his message out. He was arrested yesterday, too. Sabra Ayers reports for the LA Times from Moscow. I asked her what efforts the Kremlin has made to clamp down on Putin's critics online.
There have been bills introduced into the parliament. Last week, they introduced a bill that would try to put a stop to people using VPNs, which allows people to circumvent
virtual private networks.
Exactly. Yeah. You can circumvent, as you know, certain restrictions to access pages that are blocked. There also was a bill that wanted to restrict the use of messaging apps and some social network apps for people under the age of 14. So there have been attempts.
I'm curious, you know, Russian President Vladimir Putin, he's managed to control the message on traditional media outlets, but I'm curious why he and his information people aren't adapting and using the kind of social media platforms that attract young people.
Well, that is a great question. And I think that they're probably now realizing this is a mistake, that they didn't get in on this earlier. One of the things about these new YouTube sort of video bloggers in Russia is that a lot of them aren't just political. A lot of them are pure entertainment. And the Kremlin earlier in the spring tried to tap into that idea of making YouTube less political. So taking away attention from things like Alexei Navalny's channel, and trying to sort of tap into these young Russian video bloggers and bring them on board. They invited one of the most popular video bloggers here to the parliament to speak. But the problem is that a lot of these well-known video bloggers get advertising, and that's how they make money. I think for them and their audience, if they were to all of a sudden go from entertaining their subscribers to their channel to a political movement, they would lose a lot of subscribers and possibly advertising, because, you know, people are looking to it for entertainment.
Is it too late at this point for the Kremlin to reach this young generation online?
Oh, I think trying to predict what the Kremlin does is probably almost nearly impossible, certainly for me. They've done things in the past under Putin, has certainly done things to sort of gather the youth vote and the youth support by establishing patriotic clubs, et cetera. I just don't know. It seems like this younger generation isn't really buying into that, whereas young adults who are 10 years older than them did buy into that 10 years ago. This generation doesn't seem to be buying it.
Does any of this, the activism by young people, their use of social media, their rejection of state-run media, does it pose any real threat to Putin's government at this point?
Well, sure. I mean, I think so. I mean, if you look at these protests and at this generation that's now attending these protests, a lot of them are young and about to graduate from high school, or they're already in college, and they're looking at their opportunities in the future. And what they're seeing is an economy that is rapidly declining. It's getting difficult. There's not many jobs out there for them. They're seeing their parents' economic situation, particularly outside of Moscow, deteriorate. And I think that is really motivating them more than anything. And then you bring in a story about an investigation talking about government corruption, and the one that's been getting the most attention is, you know, accuses the prime minister of amassing mansions and having huge spending sprees for expensive sneakers. And I think that the youth are seeing that and thinking, hold on a second, this is my future, and we want something different. So, you know, we just sort of have to wait and see what becomes of this new sort of protesting generation.
Sabre Ayers reports from Moscow for the LA Times. Vladimir Putin, of course, is the latest in a long line of strongmen who've ruled Russia. Think of all those czars and, of course, Stalin. Although all that autocratic rule over the years has pushed wave after wave of Russians to leave the mother country and settle abroad, many are now living here in the U.S. So you might think that Russians who fled a strongman back home would be wary of President Trump, a man who at times seems to display his own strongman tendencies. But you'd want to rethink that. We have this report from Alina Simone, herself the daughter of a Russian family.
If you're like me, the child of Soviet refugees raised in the U.S., politics may not be your favorite kitchen table topic of conversation. Today I live in New York City, but I grew up in Massachusetts, where everyone I knew was a Democrat. Everyone except for my family, who always served dinner with a generous helping of Fox News. I always avoided talking about politics with my friends, and every time a presidential election rolls around, I still get defensive. But the thing is this, whatever stereotype people may have of a Republican voter, my parents aren't it. They subscribe to The New Yorker. They drive a Prius. They donate to their local public radio station. Thanks, guys. Their political affiliation seems like a paradox, but it's not, because any label you might stick them with, intellectual, refugee, Jewish, doesn't hold a candle to their actual experiences living under a far-left regime. That experience explains everything. Now, I'm not going to interview my own parents. A moratorium on politics is the only way our family is going to get through the Trump era. Instead, I sought out another Soviet emigre, Vadim Ярмолинец in Brooklyn, host of the morning show on Davidson Radio.
Нас хорошо слышно.
Davidson is New York's Russian language radio station. Over a million listeners tune in each day, according to their website. Today's topic on the morning show was the public outcry over Trump's election really a bigger deal than Obama's?
Мне кажется, что тут стоял такой вой о том, что он родился в Африке, а не на Гавайских островах.
Didn't something analogous happen when Obama was elected? Our host Vadim says, I think so. Weren't people raging over whether he was born in Africa or Hawaii? It was in the media every day. Seriously. I'm just trying to be an objective person. A Hillary voter probably won't agree with that assessment, but Vadim's listeners, many of them voters from Brooklyn's reddest neighborhoods, certainly do. The irony is, Vadim left the Soviet Union in pursuit of the same freedoms Democrats accused Trump of crushing. Back in Odessa, Ukraine, he worked as a journalist for the local paper Komsomolskaya Iskra during the period known as Perestroika, or restructuring, right before the Soviet Union fell apart.
I was very young, and I was very much impressed by all the slogans of Perestroika, and I trust them. But when it came to real life and to real journalistic work, it was obvious that they still do not allow to say a lot of things about what's going on. We do not have to talk about this. We do not have to talk about that.
And he felt squeezed by the government in other ways.
We were oppressed. I couldn't go to church in my country. I could lose my job. I have to hide from authorities that I'm a Christian.
After clashing with higher-ups at his newspaper and not knowing the Soviet Union was on the brink of collapse, Vadim left for America. His disenchantment with the political left stayed with him, though. Being the opposite of a communist is probably the biggest thing in Trump's favor when it comes to the Soviet emigre vote.
We've been through this. I know what is socialism. I've seen it.
Вы на волне 620 AM и слушаете Davidson Radio.
You can learn just as much about Russian-speaking immigrants and their anxieties by listening to the ads on the morning show, infomercials for immigration lawyers who will help you get working papers or refugee status.
BNV Home Care, крупнейшее агентство Большого Нью-Йорка, открыло филиал офиса на Стэттен-Айленде.
Home health aid agencies promising good salaries with benefits.
459-1900.
Soon after talking to Vadim, I meet up with Lena Antipov, both a home health aide and a refugee status seeker, and her husband, Mikhail. Back in Russia, Mikhail Antipov was better known as Mike Vivisector, frontman of the punk band, the Vivisectors. The Antipovs are about the same age as Vadim, and they felt much the same way about life under communism. But unlike Vadim, they stayed in Russia for another 20 years, witnessing the rise of Putin.
В двух словах, мы просто по некоторым признакам заметили в тот момент, что начинается опять.
Михаил tells me that after a while they began to feel like the Soviet Union was starting up again, not in the sense of 5-cent rides on the subway, but in the ideological sense that things were going to get really uncomfortable and suffocating. In early 2012, Михаил decided to collaborate on a punk song with well-known rock critic and Putin critic Artyom Troitsky, who's also since left Russia. It's called Shapu Na Na. Mikhail wrote the music and produced the recording. Troitsky wrote the lyrics and sang. Sample verse. Those bloodsuckers are busy as bees. All of them are the judo vets of KGB. Sucking and pumping and getting high, but even for them, well, the end is nigh. That message didn't go over too well. Mikhail says he started getting death threats. A few months after the song was released, the Antipovs and their two children left for the U.S. Now they joke that they traded Putin for Trump. And while many Russian immigrants view Trump as the poster child for an aggressively American brand of capitalism, he reminds the Antipovs of old-school Russian communist Vladimir Zhirinovsky. He's a longtime member of the Duma and Russia's best-known unhinged nationalist, a man who, like Trump, demonizes foreign economic migrants. But at the Russian senior home where Lena works as a home health aide, her anti-Trump views place her in the extreme minority. I was the only Russian there who was against Trump, Lena tells me. I felt really uncomfortable. When everyone was talking in this aggressive way about being overjoyed, people like me were crying. It was unpleasant. The Antipovs struggle to reconcile the seeming irony of Russian immigrants voting against what some may see as their own self-interest. It's really strange, Mikhail tells me. Immigrants from the USSR, who were themselves in a similar situation, once being leaned on for similar reasons, still like it when a leader acts like a strong man. These are immigrants that are for a president who's against immigrants. But according to Lena, self-interest is kicking in. And the pro-Trump attitude at her Russian senior home has softened in the few months since he took office. She says that those who voted for Trump, older people, were assuming he really would do good things for them and their kids, but that's now been cast in doubt. With social benefits like home health aides under threat, Lena says her clients are thinking, what's going to happen now? But morning show host Vadim Yarmolinets doesn't feel like enthusiasm for Trump has dimmed at all among the Russian speakers who listen to his show. It's not that they haven't noticed the chaos swirling around the president, but these listeners...
Now they know how to filter his words. This is something we can accept. This is something... It's nonsense.
Nonsense, theater, noise. Speaking of noise, all the stuff about Russia influencing the election and secrets being leaked to Putin... Neither Vadim nor the Antipovs care about that. Russians are pretty jaded about court intrigue. They don't even believe much of it. But I did wonder whether Vadim and his listeners, as immigrants themselves, ever feel any cognitive dissonance over supporting Trump. Did they feel a little guilty, like, but we made it? What if they'd done this 20 years ago and then I wouldn't have been able to come? Is there any of that?
It's an interesting thing, and I think about pretty often. But, you know, we came from a different country. Russia is free now. Some people who live in Russia, they will complain about their present-day authorities, about Putin, about this and that. Still, you cannot compare the former Soviet Union with what they have now in Russia.
Last time I talked to my dad, he told me a friend had approached him, recently arrived from Iraq and caught up in the Muslim travel ban drama. He asked for a letter of support. What did you do? I asked, my heart already sinking. I knew his views on the issue. What could I do? My dad shrugged. He's a nice guy. I wrote it. For The World, in Brooklyn, this is Alina Simone.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. Comic books aren't just about superheroes these days. In Uganda, they're being used to teach school kids how to identify false health claims, like the old folk tale that cow dung is a good remedy to heal burns. But Alan Nsangi says it's also about helping 10 to 12-year-olds develop their critical thinking skills. Nsangi is a researcher at Makerere University College of Health Sciences in Kampala, Uganda.
A lot of people might think that being able to identify bogus health claims is just a matter of being able to tell fact from fiction. But in our case, in Uganda, sometimes it's a matter of life and death, because people are sort of faced with all this information from east, west, and center, and some of the decisions they make based on that information end up being fatal.
Like what kinds of things?
Sometimes there are claims on TV about use of herbal treatments or use of vitamins or nutritional supplements, and people think those could be used to in replacement of antiretroviral therapy.
In the case of having HIV or AIDS?
Yes, and some of the reasons they're using that is because they're unable to assess whether this claim that's being said by someone on TV or on radio or a friend or in the neighborhood is based on scientific evidence.
Why target this particular age group, 10 to 12-year-old? What's special about reaching that group?
The demographics of Uganda, we have about 49% of the population below the age of 15. And we have quite a significant number of children still going through primary school. We have very high dropout rates because a lot of our children don't continue on to secondary school. We thought this is the best time for them to start learning critical appraisal skills because, one, in case they are unable to continue throughout their education and they stop at primary level, would have got them at a stage where they're able to learn something. Children do make decisions in regards to their health in their own subtle ways. And besides that, sometimes if children are not equipped to make these decisions right from a tender age, when concepts have been ingrained in their brains, it's sometimes too hard to now reverse the trend. So we thought that, yeah, children would be a very good way of starting this out.
So you're sort of getting them when you can, and you might not have another chance. And
yes.
And these lessons could serve them the rest of their lives or be passed
That's
on to parents.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, you used the comic art form to convey information in school books about how to identify false health claims. Why the comic art form?
So first of all, we find comics very captivating. They do not overwhelm children with too much text. Remember, English is not our first language. And then the comics also bring the story to life. Children are able to envision whatever story it is that we're trying to tell them in a way, trying to get them to understand these critical appraisal skills in an interesting and entertaining manner, but also sharpens their imagination.
Now, there's so much talk about fake news these days. Is this effort a part of that, to try to counter fake claims, try to counter the barrage of bad information?
As much as, yes, this could be seen as an effort to try and counter fake claims, it should also be clear that because of the amount of claims that are in the public arena, you cannot sort of devise a method to counteract each and every claim that's being said. For us, what we're trying to do is to try and get people not only to distinguish fact from fiction, but equip them with critical skills that they will be able to use when making health decisions.
This whole effort is aimed at educating people in low-income countries about an important issue. So did you have to try a number of models to see what really worked?
Yeah. So what we did was, comics as it is are not very common in our setting. Children are not, some of them are seeing comics for the very first time. So we needed to do something that would be socially acceptable. We started out with a small group of children that we used to meet each maybe once a week to be able to come up with comics that they could easily relate to, but also be able to interpret in order to understand that. And because we were able to do that, we got to a point where it's the message that the comics was communicating other than the comic itself, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
That was possible because we involved the end user right from the start in the development process.
Ellen Nsangi is a researcher at Makerere University College of Health Sciences in Uganda. She's also a PhD research fellow at the University of Oslo in Norway. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Finally today, people with albinism are often ostracized and treated with suspicion in many parts of the world. Albinism is the genetic condition characterized by the lack of pigment in a person's skin, hair, and eyes. And in parts of Africa, many who have the condition live in fear for their lives. Ian Brennan found that out when he visited an albinism community on the island of Ukerewe in Tanzania.
They face so many challenges, ranging from assault to harassment to rape, to murder, to mutilation while alive for their body parts, which are considered valuable on the marketplace, the underground market. And there's just the daily menace of knowing that your neighbors, your fellow villagers might want to harm you.
Brennan is a Grammy Award-winning music producer. He encouraged members of Ukerewe's albinism community to express their feelings through song. The result is an album by the Tanzania Albinism Collective called White African Power. This is I Am Human, written by Christina Wagalu.
Hawakujua kuwa mimi ni binadamu kama wao walininyima haki zangu za msingi. Hawakujua kuwa mimi ni binadamu kama wao walininyima haki zangu za msingi.
Brennan says people with albinism in Tanzania are often discouraged or even banned from singing and dancing. So some of the songs Brennan recorded are about isolation and fear. But others are about empowerment. And this one, written by Hamidou Didas, is about love.
You Are Mine is such a beautiful song because it's him singing about finding love for the first time, having all this exclusion, his father abandoning him, and now finally finding love with someone who is also from the albinism community. And the only accompaniment on this song is a bow and arrow, and almost the entire record was instrumentation-wise is found instruments from the environment on site there. So a sledgehammer, a beer bottle, the bow and arrow, a frying pan, etc. Ishawishi feza na tama tunawazika ula uishi ni kutamu yapo maisha ni magumu kuna siku ninakosa pesa unanichuma najua kwamba weni wangu na. Just a taste there of the album by the Tanzania Albinism Collective. It was recorded and produced by Ian Brennan. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening. Haki, haki, haki za binadamu, ni haki za albino pia, jamii sikieni. PRI, Public Radio International.